This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 18th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. This week, we'll be boarding the new trains that are being rolled out on one of the world's most iconic high-speed lines as we speak to the head of the Italian firm which designed them.
This new Eurostar has to offer a real experience to the traveller. The traveller has to feel that he's in a special condition to enjoy his travel.
We'll be getting an exclusive tour of a new concept store as two of our favourite London brands, Oliver Spencer and Another Country, decide to collaborate.
The Daily Telegraph voted it the best menswear store in London, which was fantastic accolade to show that we worked together very well.
And then we'll be heading to the forests as a new book explores the wonderful, mystical world of the cabin. We'll speak to cabin designers from Scotland and Finland.
It's got this fantastic engagement with nature and with quite raw and impressive nature.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. To start the show, we have some good news for regular travellers on the cross-channel Eurostar train. Those muggy grey, carpeted cabins are about to get an overhaul. Last week, the new E320 train was unveiled to the world at St Pancras Station in London. Designed by the Italian design agency Pininfarina, the new models have been designed to mark the 20th anniversary of the route and will begin zipping between Europe at the end of next year. To get an overview of the design of the new trains, plus an overview on how rail design has developed over the past 20 years, I caught up with Pininfarina's design director, Fabio Filippini.
It's a project that was very, very challenging from the beginning because on the brief of the project, there was a demand of increasing of 20% the capacity of passenger of the train. And in the meantime, to improve also the personal comfort of each passenger. So, for example, the seats are much slimmer, and at the same time, they give, because of the fact they are slimmer, they give much more leg room to the passenger. But also from an emotional point of view, the seats are shaped in a way that are quite enveloping the passenger, much more than a usual bench seat that you can find on the train. So they give a better comfort, better postural comfort. At the same time, each seat has plenty of function and accessories to give a really upgrade to the comfort, almost like being on business class on airplanes. And what is important then is that a design studio like Pininfarina not only sort out those practical and functional aspects, but also add that extra touch, which is typical of Pininfarina design, which is also giving life and giving emotion and soul to the projects.
I mean, Eurostar is one of the most probably iconic rail routes in the world. You're not designing an ordinary train here. This is, you know, sort of incredibly famous piece of industrial design. What pressure do you feel to create an iconic design for Eurostar?
In a certain way, it's something that at Pininfarina we are quite used because in our 84 years of history, we always have been trying to make very strongly iconic design. And Pininfarina DNA, design DNA, is always based on three basic values, which is elegance, purity, and innovation. At the same time, it's important for a train, for a public transportation like that, very important, very iconic, that has to last long time. I mean, it's not a product that after a year you can renew it. So it's a project that the train has to last many decades. So what Pininfarina offer in a project like that is that we didn't do something which was only associated to a temporary fashion trend, but we try to get to the real roots of what is good design by doing an object that at the end it's a long-lasting design because it's based on those essential values, like I said, elegance, given from the elegance of the line, of the flow of the shapes, from the good combination of colors, of the tones, of the materials, and then the purity, because also that is one of the best ingredients that allows a design to be long-lasting.
I mean, I think anyone who's listening, who's traveled from London to Paris or Paris to London, has realized just how long overdue this redesign was. And they're incredibly sort of become quite old-fashioned. How has rail design changed over the past 20 years since the Eurostar was begun?
From our first project, the ETR 500, which was the first high-speed train in Italy, we really took a strong inspiration, airplanes, and the way airplanes was representing at that time a sort of very upgrade way of traveling, and at the same time associating this imaginary of exclusive traveling taken into a high-speed train. And that was right, because actually the evolution that happened in these last 30 years, we could say that trains, especially high-speed train, became more and more exclusive and more associated to that imaginary of traveling in very comfortable condition with services associated. So I think the design of the train lately has to give and offer something more than a simple functional answer to transportation from A to B. The design of trains like this new Eurostar have to offer a real experience to the traveler. The traveler has to feel that he's in a special situation, in a special condition to enjoy his travel. That's why you have a lot of accessories, but that's why also the environment overall, it has to make the customer feeling very comfortable, very enjoyable. Also, for example, go to the bar. There is the bar coach, in which the bar is not just a selling spot, but is an environment that invites people to spend time there, to have area to sit down or just hang on and chatting with people. So it's something that goes much further than the simple function.
That was Fabio Filippini, design director of Turin-based design agency Pininfarina, chatting to me about its overhaul of the new Eurostar trains. Pininfarina's E320 train will hit the tracks at the end of next year. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, once you've boarded the newly designed Eurostar train and arrived in London, Monocle has long suggested you pay a visit to one particular men's clothier. Oliver Spence's contemporary yet reassuringly well-made collections have become something of a staple in terms of menswear. Little surprise, therefore, that the brand has decided to go into a new venture with another brand we respect, another country, whose beautifully simple furnishings make frequent and very welcome features in Monocle magazine. Oliver Spence's new store in Shoreditch is not only fitted out by another country, but sells various selected pieces by them. Our David Pleasant went down to the new shop and met both Oliver Spencer and another country's Paul Desoit.
It started from the need to open a store in this side of town, and then we found this triple-fronted shop, which used to belong to a friend of mine, and it's just a fantastic store with great big open windows and a really lovely feeling in it. And I just felt that this would be the perfect home for Oliver Spencer.
And actually, quite uniquely perhaps, on this street, it probably has the most windowage out of any of the shops. It's quite rare to find such a kind of big piece of window in this part of town.
Yeah, when I'm looking for retail, that's exactly what I look for. As much window as I can possibly get hold of. I'm sure there's a more technical term for it, but it works really well for a storefront. Yeah, it's very nice.
Shall we go in?
Yeah. I'm Paul Desvart. I'm the founder and owner of Another Country, who worked with Oliver in kitting out the store with the furniture and rails and shelving.
How did the conversation start? Was it Ollie came to you and said, I want you to do the furniture? What was that initial conversation?
Well, Ollie and I are friends. That's how it all started. And he did come to me saying, I want to spend some money with you. And I got some ideas for how we can work with you and your furniture and designs in our new shop in Calvert Avenue. So that was great. But more importantly, in a way, I think going back a step, is that I think the United Country brand and the Oliver Spencer brand, as businesses, as brands, are very copacetic. People have often told me that we are, as Another Country, kind of the Oliver Spencer in the furniture world. So I'm thrilled that we've come together after these years to kind of work in partnership in kitting out the shop.
And Ollie, did you just let Paul kind of go with it, or did you have some requirements?
Oh yeah, I let Paul just go for it. I'm a really easygoing guy. Not
a little bit of sarcasm in you. Paul was kind of gesticulating there a little bit.
I mean, I did some work with Paul when Paul first started the brand. I did some work with him in our shoe store, and he did some shelves for us, and they were absolutely amazing. Basically, that was about 3 years ago, and I thought that it was time to really change things up. So this was a massive departure for us, and in fact, we're going to change up all of our retail stores to this interior now. And so what I did was I sat down with Paul and said, right, I want to design a new interior for my stores. My collection's moved on from where we were at back then, and I love his feeling, use of wood, the way the wood's shaped, the way the shelves feel.
We talk about those shelves. They're really distinctive. There's a kind of niche, a nook of shelves that we're looking at, five shelves in front of us. Maybe talk about them. What are they made of? Who makes them? And so on.
What we see around us is essentially a customized Series 1 range of shelving and furniture and tables. And they were very much specified by Ollie to work with this shop and how he saw our designs really fitting with his brand in this physical space. We do this quite a lot, not quite as we've done for Ollie, but as a way of doing business. We often customize our designs. It doesn't mean we go as far as doing a bespoke design, which we can do, but it's about customizing our existing designs. So what we're looking at is a nook of shelving with a distinctive Series 1 radius on the edges. It's all solid oak. All these are made in the UK in our Norwich supplier workshop. And besides the shelves, the tables we're standing next to and some other pieces we see around the store, including some modular shelving in the back, is all a customized Series 1 design.
And can I just ask, in terms of the commercial aspect of the collaboration, is there any presence beyond that, the initial design? Are you hoping that, is it kind of a mutual market for you both?
Yeah, well, I'm a shopkeeper. I want to flog everything in the nicest possible way. But yes, the idea is that if somebody wanted to come in and specially order the furniture, especially the tables, we would do that. The tops of the tables were all burnt, basically.
There's lovely dark contrast to the legs and the bottoms.
I mean, Ollie said, can we char the tops? And I said, sure, we can char the tops. So they charred, they literally burnt, and then finished with a lacquer so they don't obviously rub off and get your hands or clothes dirty. So it's very much something Ollie wanted. I think it looks fantastic. In the shop, in different corners are actual sort of pieces that you could literally buy and walk out of the shop with. There's a bench in one corner and a couple of bar stools around. But as Ollie was saying, I too, as a quasi-shopkeeper, I'm happy to flog anything that's in my shop, and I would love to do that through and with Ollie as well. So people in this part of town who come into the store and like something can buy it, or they can call us and we can either walk out with something similar to what they see here or buy one of our production pieces.
I think we've covered the furniture and the fittings. Let's talk about the collection, the clothes. Maybe tell us some of the highlights of the autumn-winter collection this year.
Okay, well, I've got a yellow Mac over there, which I love. You know, we're very much into textiles, so it's really a textural experience when you're coming in and you're feeling, touching the cloth. A lot of it's made in England. If it's not, it's made in Portugal. All of our collections are designed around artists, so it's very important for us that we get the feeling of colour, of individuality across on our clothing. So there's a big yellow overcoat. There are wonderful blue textured blazers with cream sort of nubs coming straight through them. It's luxury, it's texture, and it's a really nice feeling. We're a contemporary brand. We're new luxury. The price point is affordable, but you'll look at the price. It's a consideration. We've just launched our new Lounge Luxe range as well, which is probably going to be good for a Monocle listener, stroke reader. It's a night to day collection, and it's stuff that you would wear perhaps as a sleep suit that's made from super soft PM cotton. There are mill washed shirts with light fitting drawstring trousers. It's very much Saturday morning stuff. You can easily go out to the paper shop and buy the paper and come home and slouch around the house in it all day.
Sounds tempting. What a nice lifestyle you're selling. You've just opened this new shop. How's it been received? What's the feedback you've had so far?
Well, we opened the door and we started working straight away. So I probably had an idea that we should have opened a store a year, maybe 2 years.
I was going to say, what took so long? What, I'm sure Shoreditch, the citizens of Shoreditch have been crying out for Oliver Spencer to come here.
Well, it goes back to your original question. And basically, it was a matter of finding the right shop. And this was the right shop. I don't really jump into retail unless I feel really at home in the environment and with the way the shop looked. And this looked perfect. So it was a really good thing. And I also think from the point of view of doing the project with another country and doing that with Paul has just made it into something very special. The Daily Telegraph voted it the best menswear store in London a month ago, which was fantastic accolade, actually, to both Another Country and Oliver Spencer, because it showed that we worked together very well.
That was David Pleasant taking a tour of Oliver Spencer's new Shoreditch shop here in London. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris, where we'll be back after this very short break.
Monocle Films visits a trio of women's wear designers in London, Brussels and Copenhagen, daring women to dress in a different way.
There's two different markets in a way. There's like the fashion market, which is really unappealing to me. And then there's the clothing market, which is much more appealing and making good quality products.
Women's Wear Heroes, our latest Monocle briefing film, now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
Hello, welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. And we go from one well-considered design retail space to another today. Leading design brand Holly Hunt opened its first European showroom in London's Mayfair this month. The 30-year-old American brand was acquired by office furniture and design company Knoll early this year, and this will no doubt help to expand the brand globally. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco went to visit the showroom and spoke to the founder of the brand, Holly Hunt. He also spoke to Alison Berger, an LA-based designer who sells her products exclusively at Holly Hunt.
Tell us, why London for your first European showroom?
Why London? London is where the whole confluence of money is. It's where there's so many people worldwide coming in from Russia to Asia, everywhere. And London itself is so beautiful and so big and so full. Why not London? Why not London would be the question. Why so late to London is the question.
And is this a part of a strategy to grow your market outside North America as well?
Yes, I think that that's the next challenge. We're definitely in a global world now. And we have 10 showrooms through the U.S. And London is London, Paris, and we opened São Paulo. We're the next on the list.
Yes, I want to talk, you know, I'm from São Paulo and I'm very interested. I believe it was your first showroom outside the US in São Paulo. So can you tell us a bit more, why did you decide to choose São Paulo at that time?
Oh my God, I thought it would be so much easier than it has been. It probably was not the easy choice. At the time that we chose São Paulo, I thought that I needed a bigger showroom in London and it was hard to find. In São Paulo, I just wanted a smaller showroom and it was it. In those years, which was about 4 years ago, commodities were at a very high price. Everything was going well in Brazil. And we thought that it would be an interesting place to open because we weren't very well known there. Probably a mistake. You need to be well known before you open. We're well known in London, so this will work immediately faster. But São Paulo has been a great experience. It's a beautiful country, beautiful people. And I believe it will work over time.
I'm sure you will. And just coming back to London, I want to know, tell us a little bit more about the space. I'm here, it looks very nice, and the location is fantastic. We're here in Grafton Street, you know, close to Dover Street. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, we looked in London for a long time, or maybe 5 or 6 years we've been thinking about London. And it was hard to find a space that I thought was large enough, that didn't have a large keynote or price to get the key from the ex-lessor to come in. And so we finally found this place on Grafton, which is on Dover Street, and in Mayfair. And if we had opened earlier, we would not have been in Mayfair. And I think Mayfair is the place to be now, especially if you have high-end, fabulous quality product. I love the building because it has a modern facade and interior, which works very well with our modern furniture. And if you look around, you see that it is a completely redone interior. Because I really look at our interiors, is there the container, the interior architecture that we redid, that you have to have good bones in order to redo it well, makes a difference when clients walk in. If the space feels good, they feel good. If the space doesn't feel good, it doesn't matter what furniture you have, they'll pick a few pieces. But if the space feels good, then it makes the furniture look better, it makes, you know, living in well-designed spaces enriches one's life. And I think it's the same thing with the showroom.
Are there any pieces specifically designed for this showroom?
The piece you're sitting on, the sofa you're sitting on, the stone table, we call it the fish, that's in front, was designed for this entrance. The rest of the pieces mostly were designed for our business, which some are new here, and some have been in the market for 6 or 8 months.
And I wonder, because of your international presence, do you think countries, they look for different pieces? Did you notice that since you started your brand?
Yes, in Brazil, because of the onerous tax situation, making everything cost twice as much as it may cost in the States, you have to be very careful about what you take in. They want special, they want limited edition things. Even though they're more expensive, it's not something they can replicate easier at a much less price. In London, it's very similar to New York. The scale of the things people buy in New York is a bit bigger. Not the scale of the pieces so much, but the scale of the spaces. Although London's, we did quite a bit of business in London last year with no showroom, with Joan, who was out talking to everyone. This is very similar to what we do in the States, and we've had a nice business in London for many years.
Alison, can you tell us about which pieces do you have here in New Holyhands showroom in London?
I have a cross-section of my collection that's been in development for 15 years that Holly's been carrying. It's a cross-section of furniture pieces and lighting.
I have to say, the lighting looks fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit more about the material you use? And how long does those pieces take to develop?
I'm an artist that works with light, whose material is glass. And while I create lighting, it's not really lighting in the sense that they're task pieces or flip a switch and you illuminate a room. The pieces are atmospheric and they're sculptural. And they're really based on the whole ritual of like electric candlelight or fireflies that I used to collect as a kid in Texas. They're small points of light held in crystal containers that are illuminated. And so the idea of the pieces are that they're on all the time and that they create this atmospheric meditative condition when they're on. And the pieces in the showroom, I use a combination of hand-blown crystal, that's a particular crystal that we've developed over the years that's of the caliber of Baccarat or Lalique. And the difference between crystal and glass is just the difference between wool or cashmere. It's just a finer quality of material. I work only in clear crystal at this time because I'm fascinated by the various forms the clear can take. It can feel like a drop of water. It can feel like a block of ice. It can feel like a breath of air. And the purity of the crystal enforces the clean lines of the form.
Some of the pieces, as I think you mentioned, it takes like a decade to do as well. So how is this process works for you when you think about a piece?
You know, sometimes an idea will come and then I'll know that I don't have the technology or the machinery or the skill set to develop it. And in particular with the counterweight chandelier, which is here in the showroom, is that the idea the piece is on a pulley system. And a pulley system is actually a very antiquated lighting technique based on, you know, chandeliers from the medieval times that would raise and lower. But to make all the components out of glass is what the challenge is of this piece. So it was how to engineer glass wheels and engineer glass counterweights that would help balance the piece. That's what took time.
Alison, just a question, where are you selling your products? Because you just told me you've just been to São Paulo as well.
I'm represented exclusively through Holly in the States, and as a result, our relationship is expanding globally. We have a showroom in São Paulo, and this is what's so exciting about being here in London, because that's been 7 years in the making to have this opening here in the showroom.
And do you think customers from different countries, they have different necessities in terms of lighting, for example?
You know, I think lighting is kind of this universal theme where in the chaos of where we are and the constant motion, I think everybody wants quiet and they want to be able to be contained and create this kind of meditative condition. So there's this great underlying theme in everything I do that there's something globally appreciated about the aesthetic. Because we're all drawn to candlelight. It's very primitive. And with that, because these are low wattage and they're meant to be dimmed down, there's just kind of this almost understanding of them, even if you don't really get how difficult the pieces are, how complex. There's this, people are drawn to them, you know, which is exciting.
So Alison, tell me, why glass is the material you work with? What's so special about it?
Well, as I say, you know, I'm an artist that works with light, and glass is my material. And I started blowing glass when I was 15. And because it's so fluid and chaotic and spontaneous, I feel like I, even after all these decades, still don't understand it. It continually surprises me. Having an architecture background, I draft and draw and try and preconceive what the form is going to look like, but the fluidity of the material continues to surprise me, and the results of the piece once it's finished is something I can never predict, and that has created endless years of fascination, and I haven't even begun to crack the code of the material, which is why I continue to work in clear crystal.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to furniture designer Alison Berger at the new London shop of American furniture brand Holly Hunt. Still to come today, we'll be going to New York, where one London-based designer is trying to make sure that his interiors are in keeping with the local heritage. We'll be discussing restoration of one of Alvar Aalto's most important buildings that happens to be in Russia, and then wrap up and venture into the forest and speak to the architects of two very unique cabins. With some very important hotels, restaurants and private club interiors already under his belt, London-based designer Martin Brunitsky has just finished his first multi-residential project in the US. In the superb Flatiron District, 45th East and 22nd Street interiors can be what any proud New Yorker would expect, with a London twist. Martin Brunitsky stopped by our New York offices to talk with Monocle's Carlotta Ribello about this recent project.
This is actually our first residential development, as I call it, in the States. I mean, we have done smaller ones in London, but this is sort of the first one here, and it's a very big project, a very exciting project. We were approached by their client, Bruce Eichner, because they felt that our approach to projects through our experience in commercial design, hotels, restaurants, bars, were the right fit for them, because they wanted to create a very interesting amenities program for this building, and they wanted some of that sort of sparkle that we can create within those areas.
What was the main difference from this project compared to the other ones you have already done in London?
Oh, the scale. It's so much bigger. I mean, we just in London completed a small development in Covent Garden in Henrietta Street, which is only 9 apartments. This, of course, is 83 apartments, and it's a tower, and it's very tall.
Did the scale scare you?
Oh, no, not at all. Size never scares me.
So what was the main challenge to do something as big as this for the first time?
It was more this beautiful, beautiful building. I mean, it's like a glass shard, basically. It's a beautiful building. And it was sort of, how do we make that intimate? How do we make it soft? How do you sort of, and it's very angular as well, so how do you sort of, as I call it, round the corner, round them off? And that's literally what we did in the interior. There are no sharp corners, because they all have a little radius on them. So it sort of like creates a little softness.
Can we say this has a typical New York interior, or does it have a London touch as well?
It's a mixture, yes. You know, of course, there is a market here that you have to sort of look at and understand. So it's sort of taking what you would perceive being a New York apartment, but it has a slightly European twist to it. And that's sort of through the finishes. But it's a very elegant, very simple and sort of contemporary approach to design. But we wanted it to sort of be reminiscent of these sort of pre-war apartments in terms of proportion, scale. So, and that's how we actually designed the apartments, so the plans, the layouts, so that there's like viewpoints and the doors are tall and all the detailing has a slight sort of wink and a nod to pre-war, because this building is in the Flatiron District and it has beautiful classical architecture. So we sort of wanted to do wink and a nod to that, even though it's a very modern building.
And what makes for a typical New York interior?
It's more sort of, I think, scale. I mean, you know, if you compare the American and the English market, it's slightly different what people sort of are looking for in terms of amenities. It's not in terms of like the color of the timber or what you paint in the walls, and it's more about what is in the kitchen, you know. What's the size of the sink and what is the size of all of these elements, which is sort of, it's slightly different from London. But it's not really in sort of look and feel. Even though what we have done, I believe, is created something that is very different in the marketplace here in New York. As well, our point of view was to do as much customization as possible. through, like, we work with Waterworks, who's doing all the tap ranges for the bathroom, to create a special lever for the faucets. We worked as well with Nance. They custom designed some handles for the building. We worked with LV Floor to create the timber floors for the building, which is exclusive to this building. So we sort of worked very hard of sort of putting things into the building that you actually can't go out and buy.
And is there any particular, let's say, signature to the building and its design features?
The feature is for the apartments is, as I sort of said, it's sort of there are no sharp corners. So basically we round all the corners. So that is sort of, if you look at a pre-war apartment, because of the old fashioned way of doing lath and plaster walls, all the corners were slightly rounded. So that is like a wink and a nod to that. When it comes to the public areas or the amenities, we have made them very comfortable. They're sort of very loungy and they're big, comfortable sofas. And it's an interesting mix of colors and patterns, just to sort of give it sort of a lived in, collected look, a little bit more eclectic than you probably would expect. And that's sort of our look. And that is sort of the difference in the sort of residential development marketplace, that the amenity space will be slightly more eclectic than you would normally expect.
And for you, as someone who is London-based, how did you approach this project?
By really looking at the Flatiron District. That's sort of where the inspiration came from. Because, as I sort of said, it is a glass tower. And we wanted to approach the project so that it would feel like you were in a space that was necessarily not in a glass tower, even though it's very modern. But we didn't want it to feel like this sort of typical white box.
And if you had to highlight a favorite detail or something from the design that you'd say that's your favorite from the entire project, can you pick one?
Oh, it's difficult. I think it's all actually very good. But if I'm going to highlight something, it's actually the vanity units in the bathrooms. Because we designed three different vanity units between the master bathroom, the secondary bathroom and the powder room. And when they're designed like individual pieces of furniture, and they all look very different. And again, it sort of fit into that sort of idea of that this is a beautiful apartment and you sort of collected these pieces and they're not supposed to be matching. So that's sort of those vanity, man, I love that. They're really, really beautiful. They came out extremely well.
That was Monocle's Carlotta Ribello speaking to interior designer Martin Brudnitsky. This is Monocle 24, and you're listening to Section D. Quite possibly the greatest Finnish architect, the buildings of Alvar Aalto have been celebrated the world over. However, one masterpiece of his was about to be lost as the result of geopolitics. In the 1930s, Aalto designed a library in Finland's second biggest city, Viipuri. However, after the Second World War, Viipuri was ceded to the Soviet Union and became more known by its Russian name, Vyborg. By the beginning of the 1990s, the Aalto Library was left in such a bad condition that something had to be done urgently. And a Finnish-Russian project got started to renovate the library back to its former glory. The work took two decades and was finally completed last year, with obvious success as it was just awarded the 2014 World Monuments Fund and the Noel Modernism Prize. Monocle's Marcus Hippi spoke to Tapani Mostinen, one of the architects responsible for the Vyborg Library restoration project.
The first time when you actually went to see this library was in the beginning of 1990s. Could you tell us in what kind of a condition it was back then?
Yeah, that was in 1991 summer, and I went with two other engineers just to see the place in what condition that was. And really, well, it worked as a library, yes, but the last renovation had been done in early 1960s. And after that, actually, nothing had been done. So that was really rather rotten.
In the beginning of 1990s, where did the initiative come to actually fix this library?
There were quite a few Finnish parties, and one association from St. Petersburg became interested of the library. And then later on, they knew some people in Finland and with the Ministry of Environment. And actually, those old colleagues from the ministry then contacted Aalto's office and spoke with Elisa Aalto, Mrs. Aalto, and then actually it started.
Well, obviously the whole restoration project took two decades. Was it because the project was so complicated, or was it because it was quite complicated to organize something like this where basically two nations are both involved?
Well, the biggest issue was money, the Finnish Restoration Committee was not a wealthy one, and we got all these fundings from different small sources, and at that time especially the Russian counterpart was really desperate as well. They couldn't offer anything from that side in the beginning of the 1990s.
Did you see the attitude from the Russian side change during those years? Do you think, say, Kremlin actually realized the value of this building?
Actually, they did, yes, because the beginning was rather difficult for us, and they didn't really understand the library or its meaning or value. But then, bit by bit, people there just got the understanding, and nowadays it's totally different. So the whole place is used as a common living room for the city of Vyborg, and people love it a lot at the moment, and the attitude is really positive towards the library.
Tapani, do you think this can be seen as a form of design diplomacy between Finland and Russia?
I think this is a good sample how two nations could really work practically. This 20 years cooperation and collaboration we have had with the library and other authorities as well has been, I'd say, very, very fruitful for all of us.
And what do you think others should learn from that?
I think culture belongs to everyone. And since you understand cities and places you live and you understand the values of those places, then somehow culture can be something which unites you and the other people in general. And that's far beyond politics.
That was Tapani Mustonen, one of the architects, speaking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie. Barry Bergdahl, chairman of the prize jury, and Henry Ung, who manages the prize and helped establish the Modernism at Risk initiative, explain the significance of the project and why it was the Vyborg Vipery Library that won the prize this year.
The most important thing for us was the extraordinary story of the perseverance and the exactitude with which this was carried out under relatively difficult circumstances for a long time in the international setting and in the international collaboration. Besides the fact that it's one of the iconic and most important buildings of 20th century modernism.
I was just going to ask you to describe this building and tell us about its significance in terms of architect Alvar Aalto's work.
Well, this is a key moment in Alvar Aalto's work, studied by many for many years without even knowing if the building was still standing, let alone what shape it might be in. It was a commission that Aalto won in a competition in 1927, and the evolution of his design already is a very significant sea change in 20th century architectural exploration. The first project looked very much like the municipal library in Stockholm by Asplund, who was one of the great sources of inspiration for Aalto. But as the project evolved from the design stage to the execution stage, he began to experiment with an asymmetrical massing of the volumes, a much more complex plan for the spaces inside, and a brilliant lighting scheme, a skylighting scheme that would become really a toolkit for his work for decades to come. So it's a key project of exploration and a real moment of Aalto's early distinctive individual maturity.
Joining us on the line as well is Henry Ng, who manages the prize and also helped establish the Modernism at Risk initiative. How do you see this? How rare are these kind of examples of international collaborations such as this?
In our battles with trying to save modern buildings, I think it's unusual to have not only just international collaboration, but the very extensive network of support that the Finnish committee created to save Vipori Library. This is a single building. It's in a rather remote area of the world, and yet they created not only international cooperation, but a whole network internationally of architects and financial supporters to really come to the support of this building over two decades. And I think it's quite impressive that they could marshal those resources. It's, I think, all of us that fight for modern buildings know what a tough battle it is on an everyday basis, and usually those battles are on a local basis.
Henry, you helped establish the Modernism at Risk initiative, and when we look at this example of Alvar Aalto's Vipery Library nowadays in Russia, are there many other similar buildings around the world that are nearly lost because of international geopolitics?
Well, I would say that, and Barry can speak about this more since he did a whole exhibition and book on it, but there are really, you know, amazingly significant buildings in Russia in the modern era that, because of the environment and the isolation, in a way, of the country, that it's very hard to come to the rescue of the number of buildings that are in Russia. And maybe, Barry, you can, you know, talk even about your own involvement with that, because it was pretty significant.
It's been a tremendous roller coaster ride, the fate of Soviet modernism in general. Of course, this is not an example of Soviet modernism, but an example of Finnish modernism that found itself after the Second World War in Soviet territory. But nonetheless, after the Second World War, modernism in general, whether it was imported by territorial change or imported by Corbusier or indigenous, since there was an extraordinary experimental period in the 20s with modernism in Moscow and Petersburg, and in fact throughout the Soviet lands, fell into real disfavor in the Stalinist period. And it wasn't until the 60s that modernism came back into a limited favor, and nonetheless did not involve recuperating the monuments from an earlier period. So there are geopolitical factors in the fight to save modernism, but there are also often ideological ones in countries that have shifted their point of view from what might have been their glory days in the 1920s.
Barry, do you think Russia understands the value of this kind of a building? And if so, to which extent? Do you think one day there will be people traveling to Vibri to see this masterpiece? And do you think this is something Russia could actually work for?
Well, I think people are already making the pilgrimage, very difficult for many for a variety of reasons. But I think one has to take some hope from the fact that at a key moment, a conversation with Putin led to some late giving of funds, rather substantial funds, from the Russian Federation to this project. So in its very final phase, it became a Finnish-Russian collaboration, which is one of the many, many factors that we wanted to recognize in the award.
And what's on your wish list? What kind of implications would you like to see this prize to actually have?
Well, I think internally within Russia, we're very hopeful for the plight of many buildings that are imperiled by the real estate boom in Moscow, notably. One thinks of monuments of the architect Melnikov, one of the few avant-garde architects who actually had a significant corpus of built work in the 1920s, and other examples. A number of years ago, with the photographer Richard Pear, who's a British photographer who devoted about 15 years to surveying the extraordinary extent of modernist practice throughout the Soviet Union, finding examples in many regional capitals even and smaller cities, and showing us that much more was built than historians had previously known, but also showing us in many situations the lamentable state of repair of these buildings. So we really hope that this prize given to Finnish-Russian collaboration in its final phase will also bolster the fight for important 20s and 30s monuments throughout the Russian Federation.
That was Marcus Hippie speaking to the various people behind the restoration of Alva Aalto's Vyborg Vipery Library in what is now Russia. This is Section D on Monocle 24, where we'll return straight after this.
Monocle's mighty December-January double issue is on newsstands now. Inside, you'll find our Portugal survey and our soft power survey too, but there's so much more to savour.
Soft power aside, there is much to get your teeth into in the affairs section. We meet five global politicians with their eye on 2015 and take a look inside the European Space Agency.
In the business section, we visit France to check on its footwear industry. Then we go up north to Alaska to see how this American state promotes its fisheries.
The December-January double issue is on newsstands now. Make sure you get your copy by becoming a subscriber at monocle.com.
Now, to end this episode of Section D, we're going to head to the forest. There's scarcely a more enchanting or evocative architectural type than the cabin. Just as the biting cold starts to arrive in the Northern Hemisphere, Taschen has published a fantastic anthology of these warming, usually wooden, structures. Life in the Woods, Creative Cabin Architecture, features a whole range of cabin concepts from Japan to Australia. And to end the show, we decided to let two cabin architects talk us through their creations. First, we hear from Malcolm Fraser, who designed the 2011 Outlandia cabin on Glen Nevis in Scotland, before going to Finland and speaking to Villa Hara of Avanto Architects, who spoke about his four-corner villa at Virat in Finland.
The Outlandia Field Station, it's a sort of off-grid artist retreat, or sometimes maybe retreats or attacks too. So we want it to be an actively engaged place. And it's in Glen Nevis, so it's opposite the Ben, it's opposite the shoulder of the highest mountain in Britain. So it's got this fantastic engagement with nature and with quite raw and impressive nature. Though we also like the fact that there's far more culture and history and heritage around than you might imagine. Obviously, there's tourism, and the West Highland Way comes past, so there's loads of people down there. There's caravan parks and there's holiday cottages and things like that. But there's also a huge amount of history there. There's the remains of Iron Age occupation. There's even modern heritage. You can see across on the far side of the Ben the huge pipes that come down from the reservoir that power the Alcan smelting plant there. Smelting aluminium takes a huge amount of energy, so that barrels down the hill there. So, you know, people often think of the Highlands as being some sort of wilderness, and the reality is that much of the Highlands have teemed with life for much of our history, and this particular bit most certainly does. I said it was on the side of the glen, the valley, and it very much is. I mean, it's an extremely steep slope. It's about 42 degrees. So building on that is an enormous challenge. We had a fantastic local builder, Norman Clark, whose skills were sort of part joinery and part mountain rescue, really, because even just getting up there was quite some doing. And building up there it was an extraordinary task. And if you can imagine, certainly we were very happy to say that some of the cabin was built with thinnings cut down on site. It's a Forestry Commission site. We're part client, as well as the local council, etc. Part of the cabin was built with thinnings that came off the site. So that sounds very nice and ecological and low impact carbon-wise, but we need concrete for the foundations, and that was landed by helicopter. So the helicopter's just touching the edge of the trees, dumping concrete down onto a 42 degree slope, which had to be sort of then, in quite a hairy way, channeled into the foundation, etc. And then the tree that had been cut as the main support lowered into that, the steel fixings, etc. So it was quite an operation, if you can imagine. It raining as well, and clouds of midges all around. Nature is quite challenging at times, and not always soft and lovely. It's a site that's really extraordinarily has a certain grandeur in those terms. You know, it's not just, as I said, for artists, and there's extraordinary things going on in there. People are commissioning work, making work. There's a radio station that broadcast there for a week earlier this year. And it's just become a real magnet and a sort of experimental bothy for all kinds of wonderful environmental art and engagement with the landscape, tourism and people.
The four-cornered villa is situated quite typically for Finland. I mean, our country cottages are often very remote from big cities. The nearest shop, for example, is 20 kilometers away, so you can really say it's in the middle of nowhere. And the building is situated on an island, so you have to take a boat to get there. There's only a couple of cottages on the island, and the nearest cottage is maybe 600 meters away, so you don't see any lights. You are quite alone on the island or on the site, I would say. The shape of the building actually came quite funnily because there's a very dense forest on the island. So before the construction work, you couldn't see any water from the building site. So even though it's on an island and surrounded by the water, you didn't have really like one certain view or only one view to open up the building. So I decided to open it to four different directions, so you have four very different views. And it's also interesting, the building is called Four-Cornered Villa because it's reaching to four different directions. You get a morning sun in a kitchen where you have breakfast. In the midday, you get a sun for the lunch table. And in the evening, you get sun in the sitting room. And actually, you get never direct sunlight to bedroom, which is very practical because it doesn't get overheated in the summertime. For Finns, holiday huts, it's really a must. Most families have a holiday home. And this is really interesting because in many other European countries, it's something very luxurious to have a kind of retreat. But for us, it's all often very simple cabin, actually. And it might be that there's not this kind of modern conveniences like running water and so on. But this is somehow changing in Finland, and a lot of people are building kind of second home where that is exactly the way they have their own home in the city. It's kind of a one family house. And that's really a big problem because if you have running water in the house, you have to heat it all year round. So you actually heat two houses for your family. And in Finland, it's really cold in the winter, so it takes a lot of energy. This is why I wanted to show kind of a different way to do this. You can have really good quality life without having all these kind of modern things like electricity and running water. So it's kind of ecological experiment or kind of model house for ecological summer hut in Finland.
That was Ville Haara of Avanto Architects telling us about his four-cornered villa cabin in Finland, which features in Tashin's new book, Life in the Woods, Creative Cabin Architecture. And that's all we have time for in this week's Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer David at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, in honour of those new Eurostar trains that will be keeping our voyagers good-looking and comfy when they hit service next year, is Voyage Voyage by Desireless. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.